Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, April 19th. Next week, President Biden will hit his 100th day in office. He has surprised many people with how bold some of his economic proposals have been. The letters FDR and LBJ are being spoken a lot these days, right? But on Friday, the president disappointed and frankly shocked many progressives by not proposing to raise the cap on the number of refugees allowed into the U.S. in the next year from the historic low that President Trump had plunged it to, just 15,000 people at a time of so many refugees in the world. Biden campaigned by citing our recent history of taking in 125,000, even 250,000 in a year. That was during the Cold War. In February, his administration floated the number 62,500 refugees for this year. Then Friday, he announced he would keep the cap at Trump's 15,000. But the backlash from advocates for refugees was so swift and so strong that on Saturday, he flipped and said it would be more than 15,000, more than that. After all, he explained the initial low number to reporters like this. He said, problem with the refugee part was working on the crisis that ended up at the border with young people. We couldn't do two things at once. But he said, now we're going to raise the number. So conservatives are seizing on the fact that he used the word crisis to describe the current situation at the border. Washington Post national correspondent Philip Bump sees the roots of the situation in the way Biden defines unity. And we'll begin there as Washington Post national correspondent Philip Bump joins us now. Hi, Philip. Always great to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
You really make an interesting distinction that I think many people haven't thought about. Biden says he is striving for unity. We hear that all the time from him. But that's different than saying striving for bipartisanship. A lot of people conflate them. What's the difference as Biden sees it?
The difference is that he puts himself forward as being a president who is going to effect change that most Americans want to see, right? So bipartisanship, we generally think about in terms of Democrats and Republicans coming together. And what Biden has said, essentially from the outset of his administration, is that's not his goal necessarily. He wants to get that if he can, but his goal really is if most Democrats and Republicans who aren't working on Capitol Hill think that something should happen, he wants to make that happen. And what that does then is it gives him the space to say, okay, we should do this COVID relief package or we should do this infrastructure bill because this is, you know, this has the approval of a majority of Americans.
So that has worked to convince Biden to go big on some of his economic policies like COVID relief and infrastructure, but help convince him to go small on refugees?
Yeah, that's my assumption, right? So one of the things that Biden is very cognizant of is that his hold on power in Washington is very tenuous. The House majority at this point is single digits. The Senate obviously is split with Vice President Harris being able to break ties. Biden knows that midterm elections tend to go against incumbent presidents, and he wants to get as much done as he can while still positioning himself as well as possible for 2022. And so when we see an issue like refugee resettlement, which is most Americans do not place at the top of their priority list, as polling has shown. This is not something necessarily, I think, where the Biden administration wants to go big and really get out in front and draw a lot of flack, particularly given how much tension they're getting from the situation at the border. I think the administration is sort of playing fast and loose a bit when they conflate the two, but it seems pretty clear this is not a place where Biden was willing to sort of step out front of where most Americans wanted him to be or were concerned about him being.
Staying on the refugees, you note that the polling popularity on refugee admissions for people fleeing violence in their home countries is lower than for creating a path to citizenship for the Dreamers, the young adults who came of age in this country after being brought to this country illegally by their parents as children. Can you flesh that comparison out for us a little bit? And why you think that comparison might matter?
Well, I think that comparison matters just to give a sense of context, right? I think there are a lot of people who understand the situation with the Dreamers and understand that issue pretty well, and who have fairly strong opinions on it. Obviously, people also understand the idea of, you know, people seeking refugee status in the United States or seeking asylum. But one of the things we notice is that it's not as prominent a concern for a lot of Americans. So there is a small group of people for whom this is a very, very important issue. But for most Americans, it is a less important issue. Not to say it isn't important. It just isn't as important in terms of the broader context of politics. It isn't as important as, say, the issue of getting citizenship for Dreamers. And so when Biden ran last year, he never positioned himself as being a president who was going to be out front on progressive issues and, you know, sort of, you know, carrying the banner of the AOC wing of the party. That was very much not what he was running as. And I think that what we're seeing with this issue of refugee resettlement is a place where he doesn't necessarily want to use his political capital in that way on this issue right out of the gates. And of course, because there is a lot of there are a lot of Americans, particularly Americans who hold elected office, who do see this as a very important issue and are trying to drive this forward. That's why he met a lot of the blowback he did on Friday.
And this even gets us to guns, which we're not going to dive into right now. That'll be a little later in the segment. But the overall Biden approach, it seems to me, is this very sort of organized, pre-planned one where he's got these big priorities. COVID relief with all the many things that were packed into that, infrastructure with all the many things, even that aren't traditionally considered infrastructure, that are packed into that. And he doesn't want those things that are really big and that he feels he can succeed on to get derailed by news of the moment, which drags him into things that are going to be less popular and therefore maybe drag down his own whole agenda. He's trying to really go in this pre-planned way with his priorities, yes?
Yeah, I mean, it's important for us to remember we're coming off of 4 years of an administration which planned almost nothing, right? And so, you know, we're sort of becoming reaccustomed to the idea that a presidential administration will be thoughtful and deliberate in the way it does stuff, which is normally how presidents work. But it also, you know, we're going to sort of have to let muscle memory kick in to some extent. What Biden is doing is smart, right? What he's doing is he's taking things that are very popular, like big $1,400 stimulus checks, and throwing a bunch of other things in with it as it goes to Congress, right? He's doing the same thing with infrastructure. Everyone wants to have more money for roads and bridges. Not everyone, but you understand my point. It's very, very popular. And so what he does is he packages it together and uses infrastructure as the thing to get it through Congress with as little static as he can. That's a smart political strategy, but you're right. Other things come up and other things drive a lot of furor and outrage in a moment that people want to have addressed. I think any president, not just Biden, I think Presidents Trump, Obama, Bush, all of them would rather not have to deal with things that are coming up in the moment and instead work on their policy agendas. Of course, none of them actually have the chance to do that all the time.
Who counts as a refugee under the numbers that we're talking about? And does that include the thousands who are coming to the border from Central America who we generally hear are seeking political asylum? That's the word in the news all the time. They're coming here seeking asylum because of the conditions in their country. Are they the same thing, refugee status and asylum, when it comes to this refugee cap?
No. So refugees and asylum seekers are considered differently by the federal government and actually track those numbers separately. The overlap here to which the Biden administration is pointing is that the Office of Refugee Resettlement also deals with children who come to the border and need to be placed somewhere. And that is something that has been a struggle for the federal government for a while. I mean, the reason that the surge in migrants coming to the border has challenged administration is not the sheer number, you know, that there were over 100,000 or whatever the number was of people that came in March. It's that so many of them were children, and children need to be handled differently by the government. The Office of Refugee Resettlement handles that. A lot of refugee advocates are very quick to point out that the process for refugees coming as refugees from other countries is very different than the process for resettling child migrants who come to the border. But that's where the overlap lies within the government.
Who are the refugees right now?
Broadly speaking?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, the cap that the Trump administration set had put very specific limits allowing people to come from particular countries. Obviously, we know that President Trump's priority was to try and bring people to the country who weren't from certain parts of the world, who weren't from predominantly Muslim countries, for example. One of the things that Biden said he would do when he revisits the cap on refugees, which he's promised to do by May 15th, is that he was going to shuffle around what countries were allowed, which countries we could allow refugees from. So, I mean, there are refugees who want to come to the to the United States from all over the world. But there are only certain countries at this point in time from which they're actually allowed, certain countries from which they're not allowed. And they sort of line up with what one might expect in terms of the politics of the president.
The history, roughly, according to the statistics website, Statista, that I looked at this morning, at the end of the Cold War, when Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush were president, we took in around 125,000 refugees a year. That gradually declined to only around 25,000 just after 9/11, 2001, but gradually rose again to around 85,000 in 2016, the end of the Obama administration, with the Syrian civil war and other humanitarian crises raging then, just before Trump was elected, largely as part of his interest, as you say, in reducing the number of Muslims, and I would add Africans and Latin Americans, right, entering the U.S. He dropped the number each year down to last year's 15,000. So that was the starting point for the policy decisions facing Biden. So what happened between Friday and Saturday? Who got to him?
Well, I mean, it's a question of what happened between Friday and later Friday afternoon, really. I mean, the administration started to walk this back. Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, what happened was very quickly you had a lot of Democratic elected officials speaking out in very, very stark terms. I mean, really, really chastising the Biden administration. And I mean, look, it's very easy to see why, from a moral standpoint, one can say, hey, look, man, this was the wrong call, right? I mean, these are people who are trying to escape violence and danger in their home countries. Some of these people have already been cleared for resettlement in the United States, but were blocked by the Trump administration. And so he heard from a lot of allies, both vocal progressive advocates and people on Capitol Hill who were saying this is the wrong call, and this is, you know, not only the wrong call, but this is an immoral decision. So the White House very quickly tried to spin it as, oh, no, there's just a misunderstanding about what we're doing. What we're actually doing is going to release this new number by May 15th. It seems pretty obvious that that was a, you know, after the fact rationalization for what the announcement had been in the first place. But it also is a reminder that in politics, volume counts. And I don't mean volume in terms of numbers always. I mean volume in terms of loudness. And the people who were being loud on Friday were people that President Biden listened to.
Before we get off the refugee and immigration question, another thing in the news this weekend was a kind of flip-flop on the Republican side. Some conservative House Republicans were apparently ready to form what they were going to call an America First caucus that had a document that said too much immigration threatened, quote, Anglo-Saxon political traditions in this country. And it also used the phrase, quote, the progeny of European architecture. And those things were widely criticized as racist and white supremacist dog whistles, or not even dog whistles, Philip, but actually right, saying the quiet part out loud about who they thought right, America was for. And by saying Anglo-Saxon political traditions, it's almost like saying, you know, black and brown people and Asian people don't believe in democracy. And so, like, we want white people, and that's how we see our country's grounding. And those Republicans went back on that by the end of the weekend. You haven't written an article on that explicitly that right, I see. Do you know what happened there?
Yeah, so essentially what happened is that people read the document, right? I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who sort of stepped out to the front as being one of the more right-wing members of Congress. This is someone who, you know, had dallied with QAnon in the past as well. She was sort of at the forefront of this caucus. This document came out. She later said, oh, well, I hadn't actually seen the document before it was released, and so they sort of slowed their role. Sort of fascinating is that Matt Gaetz, this embattled Congress member from Florida, signed on to it even after he's seen the document, which is sort of telling, I think, in a lot of ways. But yeah, I mean, this is what was described at the outset when it was first reported by Punchbowl News is described as sort of nakedly nativist, but it's not even nativist. I mean, it is hard to see something like that comment about Anglo-Saxon heritage as anything other than pretty explicit. I hate to use the term because it's such a strong term, but I mean, that is, you know, white and nationalism. You sort of put those two things together. Granted, there are always times when people sign on to political documents and they haven't really paid close attention to it. But this is the sort of thing that you really want to make sure you're paying close attention to before you make sure before it sort of is birthed into the world.
Anglo-Saxon doesn't even include Italians and Jews.
Right.
And
yeah. I mean, it's very
Irish people.
Yes, it's very know nothing. Exactly.
Jan on Staten Island. You're on WNYC with Washington Post national correspondent Philip Bump. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I'm surprised. Thank you. I wanted to call about the gun issue. And two things. One, why isn't the gun issue, the industry, being treated like the cigarette industry was treated? Two, I just lost it. Two, the regulation of automobiles saves lives. Why shouldn't a person who buys a gun have to insure it?
Jan, thank you very much. And please call us again. I think this was a first-time call, right, Jan? Am I right?
Yeah. And a very, very quick thing is who's selling guns to the Mexican cartels? I read somewhere that 75% of them come from this country.
Thank you very much. So we'll deal with all those points, Jan. Interesting, she brings up two different industries that we could compare gun industry regulation to. And I think it's important that Jan puts a focus on the industry rather than individuals who own guns. Right. So she compares it to the tobacco industry and the way that was regulated when, you know, the harm that tobacco was doing became evident. And the extent of the harm, and also to the automobile industry for the way that that's regulated, you know, on multiple levels. We could go down that list. Do gun safety advocates who want to change the laws make those comparisons?
Yeah, very much so. You know, and I think obviously those comparisons are apt in a non-political context. I mean, it certainly is the case that there are a lot of people who are injured or killed by firearms in any given year, including suicides, which make up most of those deaths. But the overarching political factor here, which I think everyone recognizes, is the Second Amendment, right? There is no even sort of murky constitutional protection to sell cigarettes or own cigarettes or own a car or drive a car. There is, however, a Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which says that, you know, in order to have a well-regulated militia, the right to bear arms should not be infringed, which can be interpreted a lot of different ways. And the National Rifle Association and other groups were very effective for decades in presenting that as sort of absolute, in an absolute protection of the right to bear arms, and spent a lot of money on politicians, and they were able to be effective. And so now it is the case that Democrats are operating both from a position where there are a lot of Americans that have firearms, and there's not any real way to think. I mean, it's hard to imagine a way in which those firearms sort of go away. I mean, these are firearms that are owned by people, and obviously trying to collect those firearms would be hugely problematic. But at the same time, you have a lot of elected officials who understand the political tension here and the role of the Constitution and are sort of wary of trying to figure out what the line is between those things.
Right. Now, when it comes to cigarettes, some of what happened with cigarettes came through private lawsuits, not necessarily through government regulation, although that happened too, requiring warning labels, things like that on the packs.
Right.
But, you know, there was that big tobacco settlement after people went to court. And there is an attempt, I think it started in Connecticut after Newtown, to try to hold gun manufacturers responsible for things that happen with their guns under certain circumstances. I don't know if you're following this. You're, you know, more following Washington politics. This is more a private litigation case. But do you happen to know if that's going anywhere?
I don't actually know that off the top of my head. I know that there has been a big push to try and hold manufacturers accountable. But I think one of the core differences here is that there was an established pattern of cigarette manufacturers trying to obfuscate the extent to which their product was deadly. There's no question that guns are deadly, right? Everyone knows that firearms are deadly. That's the entire point of a gun. And so, you know, there is a difference between an industry which is trying to mask and sell its product to people without telling them that the product is killing them, and people selling people a product which kills people, right? I mean, not to put it into stark or grim terms, but, you know, I think that sort of disadvantages lawsuits simply because, yeah, no kidding, right? and that's obviously fundamentally the problem.
Right, and which can be used for self-defense, et cetera. Let me take one more call on this, then we'll be out of time. Alan in Waynesville, North Carolina. You're on WNYC with Washington Post national correspondent Philip Bump. Hi, Alan. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. I'll make this short. With all the rhetoric that's going on, whether it's pro-gun, anti-gun, pro-liability for the manufacturers, for mental illness, what the politicians are saying, and I don't mean to sound too much of a pessimist, but I am. I think the toothpaste is out of the tube. I think we have way too many guns in this country. More, as my understanding, we have more guns than people. So that horse is out of the barn, and he is way out there, and he ain't coming back no matter what we say, no matter what we do, because we can't control all of the guns out there. We can't control all of the individuals, unfortunately, that have a mental illness. And anyone that wants to pick up a gun, whether it be a pistol or an automatic or a semi-automatic, can do so and will do so. And I don't think we're going to be able to do anything about it.
Alan, thank you for your call. And listeners, the stat that Alan refers to is one that I happen to have committed to memory. I've mentioned it a few times on the show recently after it was in a Nicholas Kristof column in the New York Times not that long ago. The United States has 120 guns per 100 people. So Alan, the caller, is right. More guns than people in this country. The next closest is Canada with 34 guns per 100 people. Think about the gap there. The U.S. is in a league of its own in this respect. 120 guns per 100 people in this country, 34 guns per 100 people in Canada, and that is the next closest. And the other number that goes with that from Nick Kristof's column is gun murders per 100,000 people. It's 3.4 per 100,000 in the United States, about 3 people killed per every 100,000 people in the United States. In Canada, the next nearest, again, it's 0.6. So that's just to remind everybody how much the United States is in a class by itself with respect to both gun murders and gun prevalence. And so, Philip, last question. The caller is so pessimistic because he says the toothpaste is out of the tube unless they go around and literally take guns away from people, which is not really maybe except in the case of certain military-style weapons, not really the plan. There are so many guns out there that the saturation availability is going to be with us for a long, long time, no matter what they do.
Right.
What do gun control advocates say about that?
Well, you're right. I mean, those stats are obviously incontrovertible. I mean, I think the question here is twofold. The first is, to your point about the alleged shooter in Indianapolis, this was apparently a young man who was able to acquire a new firearm after his had been taken away. So this is not a case of there were just a lot of guns out there and he stumbled onto one. It was instead that this was a guy who had a record that should have, you know, based on what we know, should have prevented him from getting a firearm, who was able to get a firearm. So that's point one. That seems addressable. The second is that, yes, there are a ton of guns in the United States, but it is also the case that they are disproportionately held by a small group of Americans. It is not the case, obviously, that every American has 1.2 guns in their home. It is, however, the case that a lot of Americans have a lot of guns, whereas most Americans don't have a gun at all, right? And so that means as well that while there are a lot of guns in the United States, a lot of it is because a lot of people who own guns own a lot of guns themselves. And so the density, if you will, of gun ownership in the United States is not necessarily as broad as that stat would suggest. And therefore, it does also suggest there are a lot of people who, if you want to regulate gun ownership, you can go out and figure out ways in which to make sure that those who are trying to buy guns, who don't currently have guns, that there's some regulatory aspect to what they do that doesn't necessarily exist at this point.
Really interesting analysis of that issue. Philip Bump, Washington Post national correspondent. Thanks a lot. We super appreciate it. Have a good day. Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.